With great power comes great responsibility.
Compromise where you can. Where you can't, don't. Even if everyone is telling you that something wrong is something right, even if the whole world is telling you to move, it is your duty to plant yourself like a tree, look them in the eye, and say no. You move.
Never step onto the battlefield of ideas unprepared. Before you enter the fray, you need a plan. And there's no better place to get one than right here on Tactics with host Caleb Colquitt. The Situation Room goes live now on News Radio 1440.
Good evening once again, and welcome to Tactics right here, whether you're watching us on YouTube, on Facebook, on Periscope, on Twitch, on Twitter, whether you're listening to us audio only on our website at tacticsradio.com or listening to us on the terrestrial signal, or you're not watching us at all, in which case I don't know how you're hearing me. You may need to see a doctor about that. But either way, thank you for being here with us at Tactics Radio, where speech isn't violence. Tolerance isn't love, and disagreement isn't hate. We appreciate you being with us on this Tuesday afternoon, evening, I guess evening. I know you can't see, but I'm looking out the window here, and it is surprisingly dark already. I guess it's getting to be that time of year where even by the time the show starts, the sun's pretty much set. But you know what? I'm okay with that. I like this time of year. I appreciate that it gets dark a little bit earlier. Personally, I like the colder weather. That's just me. In Alabama, cold weather is very hard to come by. So I really appreciate it when it's, you know, doesn't get above about 65, 70 degrees during the day. But before we get into the meat and potatoes, the reason that I know all of you are here, which is the latest news here in the state of Alabama and across the globe, I did want to give a shout out to the Wetumpka Tea Party, who apparently had an impromptu visit by yours truly yesterday. And apparently what happened is my dad, or as you may know him, John from Millbrook, who used to call in on the show all the time, that he was actually in the meeting and accidentally pressed the notification that his phone gives him every time my show goes live, which, by the way, that's something that you should definitely do. The way to do that would be to like either the Tactics Radio page or the News Radio 1440 Facebook page, or subscribe to our channel on YouTube. Either way, you'll get a little notification every time my show goes live. Now, I'm not sure if you'll do that on YouTube because, as we know, Google has been trying to silence conservative voices, and sometimes the notifications don't always go through. Somehow that only happens to conservative channels. But regardless, it's definitely better for you to subscribe. You're more likely to get that notification if you do that, or just check back here every single day. But I wanted to give a shout out to the Wetumpka Tea Party people that mysteriously heard my voice speaking into the void, not seeing me there, but hearing my voice when Dad, it took him a second to get his phone turned back off. But that was really cool that I was a surprise speaker at the Wetumpka Tea Party and didn't even realize it. So there you go. And speaking of events going on around the river region, tomorrow there will be a, what's the word for it? I guess a symposium. I'm going to use symposium. I don't know if that's the official title or not. But anyway, there is going to be a symposium, seminar, whatever you want to call it, on Alabama's Constitution, which it's an all-day event. And to those who aren't really big political nerds about this stuff, they may think, man, an all-day event about Alabama's Constitution? That seems a little long. Not Alabama's Constitution, because it has 900 freaking amendments, and so it would literally take months of these seminars to understand every aspect of it. But, you know, Faulkner Law is hosting this. A lot of really prestigious attorneys and different people that are constitutional experts are going to be coming in. I'm really looking forward to it. A really fun event. I've already registered. I don't know if registration is open to the public. I would imagine it is because the Alabama Bicentennial Commission is helping host it. So I imagine it's open to the public. If you want to look that up and sign up right now, it'll be an all-day event tomorrow. If not, you get to hear some of the things that I'll probably be talking about and giving a short summary of that. I don't know if it'll be tomorrow or it'll be the next day, but either way, we'll get that to you at some point. But in the upcoming news of the day, I did want to mention this because I really have thought about this a lot. And it's something that has always bothered me. It's something that I've been aware of virtually my entire life, or at least the portion of my life that I spent actually paying attention to politics. So it's just been something that it's not urgent, but it's definitely something that I've been aware of. And I'm talking about the fact that the state of Alabama actually runs several retail stores dedicated to the sale of alcohol. And I'm sure that you've seen these things over and over again. You're all familiar with them, the ABC package stores. The reason that you may not know, and I'm not going to go into all the history, but just a brief summary of the reason that Alabama as a state government is actually in the business of selling booze, it actually all goes back to proration in the 1920s. When the sales of alcohol were made legal again, and the and that law was taken out of effect, proration was done away with via constitutional amendment. When that happened, they started instituting sales of alcohol so that they were going to try to, I guess, kind of ease into it. And it was a way for the state to more closely regulate the sale of alcohol without actually directly controlling it and trying to keep anybody from getting it. So it's kind of a relic. It's kind of a holdover from days gone by. But Senator Arthur Orr has renewed his efforts to end the state sale of alcohol. And I'm going to get into some of my personal thoughts on it and my ideas about it. But before we do that, it's really important to understand exactly the scope and breadth of what we're talking about. First of all, there's 170 stores across the state of Alabama that is run by our state government. And because of that, the ABC stores serve different citizens of Alabama. Honestly, and you guys know this because if you've been watching my show for any amount of time, you know I don't necessarily think that it's always sinful to consume alcohol. There's certainly medicinal purposes for it. I don't think that as long as you're not getting drunk from a biblical moral perspective, that consuming alcohol is necessarily immoral, but I've never done it. I just don't drink. It's just my family has a history of alcoholism. I don't want that temptation. I don't want even the ability to. I don't even want to put myself in a situation where I would even be tempted to get drunk. And because of that, I've never tried alcohol. That, and also I'm easily disgusted by smells, and I really can't stand the smell of beer. Honestly, that may be as much it as anything, but I mean, I can just smell beer and it turns my stomach a little bit. So no desire whatsoever to get engaged in that, and I've never actually been in one of these stores, but from what I've heard, they're actually not poorly run. They're one of the few things that the government seems to actually do a decent job on, which is a little bit odd. And strangely enough, looking at it from the numbers, it does not operate at a loss. Unlike many of our state programs and many of the endeavors that our state pursues, this is one of those things that it actually doesn't lose money on. It actually makes money back, in fact. And that's a little odd, but I mean, the numbers don't lie. And so Alabama has been operating to where this isn't something that loses us money. In fact, it actually makes a little bit of money. And also, this is another strange aspect of this system that we have. There is a chance that because we're using government subsidy, that our alcohol is actually cheaper in the state of Alabama than surrounding states because the state actually does run those stores. Now, there's some data that kind of conflicts with that, and you have to also take into account that, yes, our alcohol is cheaper in those stores compared to some other states, depending on what product you're talking about. But the thing is, that's true of a lot of things because the cost of living in Alabama is considerably lower than a lot of other states. It's because we have a low tax burden and several other things. So that's not conclusive. But there's a good chance that at least some of our alcohol sales are being at least slightly subsidized by the state government. And because of that, our alcohol may be just a touch cheaper than other states. I don't think that it's necessarily a significant amount and thus not really a significant factor. But the point is, when you're looking at it, that really is something that I think that you do consider. But nonetheless, Senator Orr, Arthur Orr, went on PBS Capital Journal the other day and said this, quote, "I'm going to tilt that windmill continually. I think it is a thing that we need to do. I chuckle, but it's serious. I think the state has no business in being in the retail sales of alcohol. If we were designing state government today, Don, would we have, would we think, well, let's get into the retail sales of anything, for that matter, of alcohol? But then we have the private sector down the street that we're competing against. So it's been tried before, and I'm perhaps a little stubborn and going to keep trying. I think we're going to come with something different this time, and we're going to see where we go. Now, this is a measured response, and Senator Orr understands that this isn't something that's like a big gaping problem. It's not something that if we don't take care of it right now, it's going to be a big issue down the road or going to cause all kinds of problems for the state of Alabama. That's not what he's saying. There's no alarmism in his statement. He's just saying, this is something I think the state ought not be doing. And because of that, I am going to continue to try to make sure that the state no longer does it. It's a very reasonable response. And honestly, I concur with Senator Orr's thoughts on the matter. There's a couple of reasons why that's important. First of all, I have absolutely no evidence whatsoever that this is happening now. I think that there is some evidence that this has happened in the past. The people that are actually on the ABC board, they have fairly high paying compared to, you know, the normal average person's salary, fairly high paying government jobs with a lot of benefits. And because of that, that does incur cost. Again, the thing as a whole, the ABC stores as a whole do operate at above cost. They actually make money for the state as opposed to losing it. So I'm not saying that the cost is too exorbitant, but I am saying that could be used as a kickback for a corrupt politician to give one of his buddies or one of his relatives some kind of cushy government job to be able to run the ABC stores across this state. Not saying that it's happened, just saying that it's a possibility. And because that possibility is there, we do have to recognize that that is a risk by having yet another function of government that seems to have no real basis in what government should actually be doing. And that's one of the things that Senator Orr touches on right there. He says, if we were designing the government today, would we look at that and say, yeah, you know what? The state should definitely open up some package stores. That doesn't make any sense. And he's right in that, that because this thing is obviously a relic, it's something that is sort of standing up as a testament to days gone by. Remember, it was done specifically in the wake of proration and the country coming out of that time. So it doesn't really make a lot of sense that it's still hanging on. Now, that doesn't mean that every old policy or every old branch or function of government is necessarily outdated, and because it's old, we need to get out of it completely. I'm not saying that, because that's not a logical argument. What I am saying is he makes a good point that the argument, that is an illogical argument. But what is also an illogical argument is, well, it's not hurting anything, and that's the way that we've always done it. So you could have an illogical argument on both sides for this, and there are some people that do make that argument. Well, it's not costing us money. In fact, it's making us a little money, and we've always done it this way, so we should just keep doing it. Well, that's not really a good reason to continue to do it either. So I understand that, and here's some of the reasons that I think Senator Orr is actually correct on this. First of all, there is no reason that any private business should have to compete with government. No reason at all. And this is something that I feel personally affected by. Not because of the state per se, even though the state is involved in a little bit of this. But think about NPR. I directly compete with NPR. They are my direct competition. And the reason that that is unfair is because they don't have to justify by way of profit their programming, their decisions to a customer base. In other words, you, the listener. They don't have a company that looks at that and says, well, I understand you want a new studio, but you're not pulling in the numbers. And that's something, that's a conversation that I've had to have with my bosses at News Radio 1440 before. You ever been inside an NPR studio? It is immaculate. I mean, swanky, and it doesn't matter how big the market, how small the market, all the latest equipment, state-of-the-art stuff, and it's really hard for you to have to compete with that. It's really hard because, for one, they never face failure. There's no chance whatsoever, and I'm trying really hard not to get off on a tangent on this, but there is no danger whatsoever that NPR is ever going to go out of business. And not only that, they are required to have a presence in every market. Well, boy, it would be really nice for me to have that advantage. It would be really nice for Tactics to be guaranteed to have airtime in Birmingham and Mobile and Huntsville and some of the other communities, Auburn, Tuscaloosa, around the state. Yeah, that'd be really nice. It would be a really big advantage to have that. But I don't. And everything that I do, every customer that I bring in other words, every viewer that I get, every rating that I get, I have to justify it to a boss and say, this is making money, this isn't, and this is what we should be doing more of. NPR doesn't have to do that. And there's a similar thing that goes on with the ABC board. Even though the ABC board, like I said, does not operate at a loss, it's still competing with the private sector. There are package stores, private package stores in the state of Alabama, that are unfairly disadvantaged because their competition is being subsidized by the government. And they don't face the threat of, well, if you don't make money, you're going to have to go out of business. They don't have to do that. They don't have to worry about that. And the thing is, even if the private business is operating more efficiently and better and more to the customer satisfaction than the ABC store, the difference is they still have to face failure. So if you've got the ABC store and Joe Schmo private package store over here, well, if the ABC store outcompetes and they have the better service, the better products, whatever else, you know, is involved in that, and whatever, I don't really know how people make decisions on what package store to go to. No matter what they do, they're still going to be there. Even if they're completely mismanaged, even if they fail miserably, or even if their sales don't justify them being in that community, they're still going to be there. The private package store may succeed or it may fail, but even if they succeed and even if they're actually doing better than the government-run one, they're still going to have to compete against a store. And if that were a private store, they would go out of business and they would be able to corner the market because they served their customers well. The ABC store prevents that from ever happening. And it also prevents a second, what's called market saturation. It also prevents a second package store that could take its place from cropping up when one particular store is mismanaged or doesn't have great service or is in a bad location or whatever other reason that it would normally cause it to fail. They're going to continue to be there. That's why it's unfair to ask private businesses to compete against a government entity, because they have different goals, different justifications, and the competition is going to be necessarily unfair for one group. And that really goes back to this idea of whether or not something is a public good. Certain things are public goods and are not commodities. And the reason they are public goods is they have to have two things. They have to be non-excludable and non-competitive. If something is non-excludable and non-competitive, you can make a good case for it being a public good. Let's take this example, police officers. Well, a police officer does not have time to, when he gets a call that somebody is robbing their house, say, hey, are they caught up on their taxes? Hey, is this somebody that voted for it? That's not something that they can do. They can't operate like a business in that sense. And so we give government a monopoly on violence. Police officers are allowed to respond in a certain way, whether or not the person has actually paid their taxes. And that's why it's important to try to get everybody to pay their taxes, because there are certain portions of the public good that they continue to use. They use those services regardless of what they actually pay into the system. And because it is non-excludable, it necessarily has to be a public good as opposed to a service that you purchase. And the same thing would be true of, for example, firemen. The same thing would be true of the Army. You know, when the military goes off to fight terrorists, fight the Taliban, fight whoever else may be America's enemies, they can't can't exclude certain people from that service. They can't say, all right, Nazis, back in World War II, if you invade America and you just hit these houses on the map, they actually haven't paid their taxes. So them, you're okay to attack and we're not going to protect them from you. You see how that's non-excludable? When they protect someone, they have to necessarily protect everyone. And you can't really quantify that with a dollar amount. And because of that, military is a public good. And it also has to be non-competitive. Now, I'm not going to go into depth on this because I kind of already explained why government being in a competitive market is a bad idea. But essentially, if you can, if it is non-competitive, if there is not a bidding war or competition that can be entered into a marketplace, that is also a good reason, as long as it's also non-excludable, for that thing to be a public good. To go back to the analogy of a police officer can't say, all right, it looks like that guy's getting mugged. Hey, guy that's getting mugged, tell you what, you choose out of the three of us which one you want to buy. And the police officers start a bidding war saying who can get the best price and who's willing to save the guy from being mugged at that moment. That doesn't work. It's not a competitive market. And so because of that, police officer protection is a public good as opposed to a private institution. And so if anyone ever tries to make the case that something needs to be a public good, those are the two things that you need to ask. Is it excludable? And is there competition involved? That's one of the reasons that things like healthcare or welfare or a ton of other government systems that we have now, it doesn't make sense that they're a public good. And honestly, the further we go and the more advanced our technology becomes, it's getting to the point, honestly, that schools are even, you know, it's questionable whether or not they should be a public good anymore. But I won't get off on that argument right now. I think in the past they definitely were. Now it's getting a little bit hazy as to whether they should be a public good or a commodity. But regardless, I'm not going to get off on that argument right now. But there are other compelling arguments other than the principled one. In other words, well, government just shouldn't be involved in running the ABC stores. There are other arguments that I think are compelling that you can make that actually there would be economic growth in the long run. Now, like I said, it actually makes the state money. But I think there is an argument that would actually make more money and bring in more revenue if we stopped running them all together and just took taxes from private stores. And here's what I mean by that. First of all, we would lose all the direct revenue and we would only have to draw taxes from private package stores as opposed to just getting all the revenue. Well, actually getting all the profit, because you would have to subtract costs from that as well. So you would lose all the profit. But the thing is, you would also lose all the overhead and cost associated with it. So yeah, you would be losing all the money that ABC store rakes in, but you also no longer have to pay rent at those 170 different buildings that ABC operates in. You also don't have to pay the board. You don't have to pay the management and the, you know, all of the different decision makers and bureaucracy that goes with running a 170 location organization, essentially a business within the state of Alabama's government. And so because of that, it actually makes a lot of sense that we may make more if we just bring in tax revenues from private stores as opposed to spending the money to keep inventory and manage the stores ourselves. So that's one argument. Another one is any taxes brought in from the private stores would be pure revenue. So in other words, there would be no cost associated with them at all. It would just be windfall of money coming in, nothing going out. So along the same lines, but it's essentially the same argument. Then taking the state out of the business would result in many new stores opening, because if all of a sudden the ABC stores go away, and I don't even know that necessarily doing it overnight is a good idea. I think that phasing it out would be smartest and give the market some time to adjust, because there's going to be some shock regardless of how slowly you do it. But allowing the market to kind of adjust and have a lot of private alcohol vendors open up, and maybe even make the process of getting an alcohol license a little bit more lenient. I haven't studied that as much, so I don't really know if it's already too strict or not. But allowing more stores to open up their doors to that is going to be ultimately better for the economy because it spurs on hiring. And a lot of the former employees of the ABC stores, they would just cease to be government employees and could go straight into working at some of the package stores. We would also be collecting taxes on their salary too. So there's a lot of reasons why getting out of this business may be beneficial for us economically in the long run, and that shot in the arm for the economy might help bolster sales and all kinds of other things. So it's hard to tell exactly. It would be very difficult to get a solid prediction on what this would do to the economy. But luckily, we have other states that we could look to do some comparison and see about how much they bring in from things like alcohol sales. So I think that it's a good idea, and I think it's been long overdue for our state to get out of this business. But I just think that it's smart. It makes sense for us to do this. Now, moving on to more local news. One of Alabama's own helped bring down al-Baghdadi. So you remember from yesterday, we had Bakar al-Baghdadi, who the leader of ISIS, was taken down. He wound up igniting his own suicide vest and killing himself, sadly taking three of his own children with him in the process. But American forces were closing in on him, which is the reason that he did this. And now we know that one of the primary players, we don't know how big a role he played, but one of the primary players in this actually has very deep ties to the state of Alabama. And I'm talking about Lieutenant General Scott Howell, who is a general in the U.S. Air Force, who is a commander of the Joint Special Operations. And he is a commander at Fort Bragg in North Carolina, and that is the group that led the raid. So he was the leader of the group that sort of orchestrated the whole thing. I know that that's a little bit confusing. I don't really understand how it works all myself, not being a military man. But the point is, he was in charge of the group that put this whole thing together, that planned it. And so we know that he played an instrumental role. We don't know exactly how much because the exact details have not been released to us. They continue to be classified. But General Howell played a pivotal role in this. We just don't know how much of a pivotal role. And some interesting things about General Howell. He is the first Air Force leader to lead this, to lead the command of the Joint Special Operations. So that's really cool, a milestone for him. Apparently, he's the first Air Force leader to do this. His specific role continues to be classified. We just know that he led the group. And General Howell is a Kentucky native, but he went through the United States Air Force Academy in Fort Rucker, Alabama, in 1987 as a helicopter pilot. Then he went on to attend Squadron Officer School at Maxwell, right here in the capital city, right here in Montgomery. He attended that school in Maxwell in 1991. And here's another fun little nugget. Not only is a lot of his military career, significant parts of his military education, not only did that take place in the state of Alabama, but his education outside the military was also contributed to by the state of Alabama because he currently holds a master's degree from Troy University. So that's really cool. Somebody that was really that important to the mission, who helped put this whole thing together. He has very deep ties to the state of Alabama, and that is something that I just thought was really awesome. And we, of course, salute and applaud General Howell and all those involved in that mission for successfully bringing Alabama, America, and more importantly, humanity's enemies to justice. The world is a better, safer place because of your service, and we certainly appreciate it. Alabama, you know, there are times where people have kind of a negative stigma towards us. We all know the redneck jokes and all the other stuff. This is why I just ignore all that crap. This is the reason why I don't pay attention to any of it, because yes, Alabama's flawed. It's not perfect, just like every other state is not perfect and has things in its past that it's not proud of, things that it's not necessarily always done well. This is why I think that overall it's a great place to live, a great place with a great history. We have great people. I mean, just salt of the earth, excellent people. people that choose, when they have other options, to make a life here, to get an education here, to be a part of our state, even if it's just for a little while. And that's why I love my home state. Love Alabama. And that's the reason. It all goes back to the people that are here. Honestly, I don't really like the weather. And there's certain things about the government that I don't necessarily like. And you hear me voice that on a regular basis here. But ultimately, I do love the people of Alabama. And that's the reason that I choose and continue to choose to call it my home. And, you know, I wouldn't trade this guy or some of the other amazing Alabamians that we've had, whether it be in military, whether it be in the realm of civil rights, whatever else it is. I wouldn't trade those people for all the movie stars and musicians, even though Alabama has quite a few musicians ourselves, for all the other people, famous people from other states. Man, I got to tell you, I love my state and I love the background and the people here. And this is just one more example of that. Now, before we move on, I would like to talk about somebody else, not an Alabama native, but someone else that was involved in the mission whose role we do know. Now, it is the individual who chased al-Baghdadi, leading the charge into that dead-end tunnel where he wound up cowardly killing himself by means of suicide and taking his children with him. We know the soldier that was actually in charge of doing that. President Trump declassified his identity and picture the other night, and I would like to show you his, oh, excuse me, her picture. So if we can bring that up. There we go. So it was actually a dog. And I just thought this was really cool. Now, you know I love dogs. I adore dogs. And this is the best dog. As much as I love my dog, right now, this is the dog of the hour. Who's a good terrorist killer? You are, yes. So this dog is named Conan. Now, we originally did not know the dog's name, but that has been declassified as well. Originally, we just got the picture of the dog that chased al-Baghdadi into the cave. Now we have the dog's name, Conan, but actually it is a girl. That was declassified as well. So I really hope they fed her bacon right before the operation. Like, I know that there would be no way to do this because it was a secret mission and they kind of ambushed him. But I would really like for al-Baghdadi or anybody that got bit by this dog to know that the dog had just eaten some kind of pork right beforehand. That just would be the cherry on top of the sundae, knowing all this, because of course they see pigs as an unclean animal. And we do know the dog's name now. Like I said, it is Conan. But we didn't know it initially. And this set off on the social media, the interwebs, if you will, a series of people trying to figure out what the dog's name might be. And so I tried my hand at this. These were my top guesses as to what the dog's name might be. So mine was number one, Payback. Thought that was appropriate. Number two, Crypto. For those of you who don't know Superman comics, that's Superman's dog's name. So Super Dog, Crypto. Number three, Cerberus, the dog that guards the underworld in Greek mythology. Number four, kind of goes back to my bacon comment, Pig. I would just love for a bunch of Muslim terrorists to be like, well, how did they die? Well, they were eaten by a pig. Just be the most disgraceful way to go. Can we train attack pigs? Is that a thing? Because I would totally get on board with that. You know, I'm a fiscal conservative. I don't like spending a lot of money. I am perfectly okay with spending a few million dollars on a method to train attack pigs to go after Muslim terrorists. They're smart animals, and they can be aggressive, and they can actually do some damage with their teeth. But if we could pull that off, I would totally be in favor of that. I would love to learn how to train an attack pig. That would just be the coolest thing ever. I would love to put that on a resume. And then finally, my last guess of what the dog's name may be, Towel Head Eater. I just think that's incredibly appropriate. Towel Head Eater. That's what I would name the dog, I think, if I were in charge of naming the dog. But in the wake of all this and all the you know, everybody left, right, whatever, talking about the dog and the heroism of the dog. And they just kind of fell in love with this animal and should. I did too. The Babylon Bee decided to put out, and I got to tell you guys, the Babylon Bee has quickly become one of my favorite websites. It's a satire news site, so they do fake news, but they do it knowing that it's fake news and trying to make it funny. So the Babylon Bee puts this out earlier. I want you to see this headline, which was just hysterical, about the dog. CNN uncovers evidence hero dog sniffed dozens of butts back in college. So you can see there the fake CNN headline, exclusive so-called hero dog sniff numerous butts during college parties. You know, I do love the joke. And the great thing about satire, and I've said this for a long time, I wish I were funnier. I really do. I wish that I were more along the lines of Steven Crowder, one of those guys that are just really good at doing parody and news, or, you know, Babylon Bee. But one of the things that I do love about satire is that sometimes, because it's trying to be funny, it unveils a meaningful truth underlying it. And really, it's very obvious that what they're pulling this from was the Brett Kavanaugh situation, or the way that CNN and the liberal media tries to destroy every single person, even if they're trying to do a good thing. We remember the Covington kids with the Native American. You remember that whole debacle. And more recently, one of the things that I thought about was the guy on ESPN who had the sign with, I think it was it Budweiser or Bud Light, one of the beer companies, and wound up raising over $1 million to help sick kids. And CNN went through his old tweets or whatever, and Anheuser-Busch wound up cutting ties with him because he had tweeted racist things, like, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, which he was an idiot high school kid. I mean, I don't know that it makes a lot of sense to do that, but here's the thing. Just because I like something that a person did doesn't mean that I am automatically endorsing every action or every word that they have ever said or ever done. That's not how this works. I can like something that somebody did and applaud them and still not like every single thing in their past and not want to go digging through their past to make sure that they're pure enough. I do think it's really funny that the left is constantly berating the right and saying that they're like old school marms or they're sticks in the mud when it comes to especially the evangelical Christian right. And yet, when it comes to their ideology, they're worse about it than any Christian I've ever come across. I mean, we can't even say that someone did a good thing by raising money for sick children because he said something racist a while back. Well, that's dumb. I don't necessarily agree with the racist thing that he said, but that doesn't mean I have to hate every single thing the man does from now to the end of his life. That's a ridiculous standard to hold. And same thing, like, if a dog takes down a terrorist, I don't care that he sniffed butts in college. No, I'm kidding. And here's the thing. You don't need to be dismissive about it. You don't ignore past wrongs or past offenses. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying you do put it into context, and this is the difference in many ways, the modern left and the modern right. The right can look at actions of people and say, you know, there's some things I like, there's some things I don't, there's some nuance here, and I can condemn some actions by a person and also condone and applaud some actions by that same person. What the left has done is they've basically become Pharisees when it comes to this. No, that person said a racist thing 25 years ago. He is impure, unclean. You can never have that person in polite company, that you can never acknowledge that person ever did anything good with their life. They really have taken it to an insane religious level. And it's unhealthy and it's not good for them and it's not good for others. But this really is, unfortunately, where they found themselves. And this Babylon Bee article points that out perfectly. But ultimately, when it comes to this dog, dog is always going to be man's best friend. But right now, this dog is America's best friend. And so we salute General Howell and the other brave men of our military involved. And we also salute our canine soldiers as well. Thank you for the work that you do. You deserve a strip of bacon. And for this dog, definitely too. All right, so we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in just a minute.
Hey, where are you going?
Champ? Slugger?
Hey, cowboy?
Where are you going?
Where are you going?
I'm going out!
Hey, y'all. I am on I-85 heading south, coming back from the loveliest village on the plains, back to Montgomery. And part of the reason that I wanted to talk about this is because I just got back from Auburn judging a parliamentary procedure contest. One of the things that it teaches young people is the art of debate. And because I was judging that, and because I was thoroughly impressed with a lot of the kids that I saw today, it really made me appreciate it, made me think about what an integral part of being able to debate a topic is to a person's education. And it's the really intelligent young people that are able to engage in this contest. It's a very difficult contest. You don't even know what the subject is going to be until 1 minute before the contest starts. And so you have about 60 seconds to, in your mind, come up with four debates, whether this topic is a good idea or a bad idea. And you have to be able to think on your feet, and you have to be able to debate back and forth with your teammates. It's an incredibly difficult contest, even though, as a general rule, there aren't a lot of people that go through this contest that continue to use the rules of parliamentary procedure later in life. And I'm sure some do with their local churches or small organizations like that that actually use Robert's Rules of Order. Really, what the contest teaches is the art of debate. You have to be able to think on your feet. You have to be able to very quickly come up with compelling arguments and to form your ideas and your thoughts about a topic into a coherent piece of thought and convey that to other people in such a way that it convinces them to side with you. And I was thinking about this, and this is a contest that you can't participate in until you get to at least the ninth grade. And it really made me sit down and think about how criminal it is that we don't teach our students debate much earlier. But there was a time where a staple of Western thought, that if you were an educated person in the West, you were started on debate at a very early age. In fact, it was not at all uncommon for somebody to be well-versed in the art of rhetoric, well-versed in the art of persuasive speech from a very early age. It was one of the very first things that they taught. In ancient Greece, for example, going all the way back to the birth of Western civilization, they started you on that when you were about five. They started you on geometry, of all things, and rhetoric. And the reason for that, the rationale for that, was that it was important because it taught you how to think critically. In other words, if you were involved in rhetoric and you had to learn how to put your thoughts together that quickly, and you had to challenge ideas and sometimes even take the opposite side of the position that you actually held on an issue, it taught you those really critical thinking skills. And because of that, the rest of your education was easier, because nothing teaches you a subject like having to defend it against attack, or the opposite, having to attack it and finding the places where the thinking is flawed or where the ideology needs some improvement. And so because of this, this was a staple of Western civilization really up until about 100 years ago. And it's part of the reason that the education system worked so well for so long. For the longest time, our students had to not only learn material, but had to stand up and defend it, or stand up and be critical of it. And that really helped them understand and absorb the material. And furthermore, because they started out with that first and developed their critical thinking skills, the rest of their education was more robust because they had those critical thinking skills and those problem-solving skills to begin with. So it made a real difference in our education system, and it's something that I believe is sorely lacking, something that we need to bring back. And another bit of social commentary on this is that when it comes to the stereotypical characteristics of some people in my generation and the generation after it, Generation Z, what do you typically think about? They have a hard time taking criticism. They don't like hearing ideas that are not shared by them. There are things that they say is actually violence or harmful to their health to hear ideas that they disagree with. Well, the reason that that wasn't the case for the longest part of Western civilization is because we took on the idea that you ought to have to defend your own ideas, that ideas ought to be observed critically, and that you should have to go through and test whether or not something was true or not. That's really not the way education works now. They give you facts that they say are true and then expect you to just sort of regurgitate them on the test. That's not an education. That's memorization. And there's nothing wrong with memorization. Memorization is great. I'm an advocate of it. But it's not the same as having to defend your ideas.
And welcome back, everybody. Thank you for being with us through the break, as always. There's a story that I saw today, and it made the media rounds again. It's actually an older story. It's actually from April, so this isn't late-breaking news. It's actually several months late. But I saw this story, and I was just like, you know what? I have to do this story. I know that it's an old story. It's just being recycled, making the media rounds again. I don't care. I love this story so much. It just made my day. There is a Florida woman who is 65 years old. She's a grandma who fought off an invader. Actually, somebody who was trying to steal her car with a baseball bat. So this is the headline from Gainesville, Florida. This comes via WNBW, an NBC affiliate there in Gainesville. A man is in jail with a gash in his head after police said he tried to burglarize a 65-year-old Florida woman's car. Clarice Gainey said she heard a noise outside her apartment and peeked outside to see a 300-pound man pulling on her car door handle while wearing only his boxers. So a master criminal, this dude is not. So I grabbed my bat. Oh, sorry, this is a quote. So I grabbed my bat and I braced myself and eased the door open, Gainey said. That's when the 5'6", 300-pound Ontario Mosley charged her, police said. Little did he know she was a high school softball player. I tucked that bat and hit him upside the head. I love that she added the hit him upside the head. That's perfect. Also, this dude is 5'6 and 300 pounds. He's a big dude. And I don't think it's smart to burglarize somebody if you're that out of shape. Even if she is kind of elderly. But anyway, the best part of the story by far, though, is hearing her tell the story in her own words, and so I'll leave you to it.
I took that bat and hit him upside a paya. He said, oh, if he better be glad I didn't have a gun, because I would have shot him. But this is my gun right here, because I'm going paya.
You gotta love that. I mean, this little old lady, it would be certainly understandable and nobody would think twice about her being still shaken up. And nope, not her. She was like, well, saw him coming and whacked him in the head with the bat. Which is exactly what she should have done. I mean, that's phenomenal. I love that. And yeah, there's a very obvious pro-gun message there that if she had had a gun, she would have just taken it out and shot him. But and she even says that herself. But the bottom line is, I think the real message here is just be aware of your surroundings and be ready to take action. That's really what this all boils down to, in my opinion. And whether you have a gun on you or not, if it's just a bat or a stick or even just your hands, being willing to take charge and make sure that you are not a victim. That is the thing, because they always tell you to like run and hide and don't engage. And there are certain times where that is the best course of action. I'm not saying that that's never the right thing to do. Sometimes it is. But I also believe that if more people took the stance of I'm not going to be a victim and take up arms and actually defend themselves, you're going to have criminals that are thinking twice about actually doing something like this. And I think that this chubby little dude is definitely going to be thinking twice about trying to take somebody else's car, especially if they're a granny who has a baseball bat. Really, ultimately, this is about being willing to act and being aware of your surroundings and being willing to fight back, more so than the message about, you know, gun control or anything else that could be provided. And the bottom line is, I just really enjoy the story. Don't steal Granny's car. That's the lesson. That's the moral at the end of this story. Let's go to the Daily Dose of Stupid.
Now, you've messed it up. You're stupid.
And for today's Daily Dose of Stupid, it comes to us via the city of Washington, D.C. Now, granted, Washington, D.C. is normally the source of most of our Daily Doses of Stupid. I think that that's fair to say. But today, it's not a person from Washington, D.C. It is the city of Washington, D.C. So quite a bit of stupid going on here. And to understand this, there was recently a baseball game being played there. It was for the World Series, of course, Nationals versus Houston Astros. Go Astros. That's the side that I fall on this, because I freaking hate the Nationals, because, of course, they are the rivals of the Atlanta Braves, who play right here on News Radio 14. Well, logo's over there, right here on News Radio 1440. We are the home for the Atlanta Braves, and I'm a big Braves fan, so I don't like the Nationals. Much rather have Houston win it. I like it. I think it's a great city. But anyway, there were a whole bunch of people that when President Trump decided to attend the Washington Nationals game, there were people that came that were booing when he came up on the screen. And so I'll show you a clip of this via The Guardian. Can you hear the boos in the background? And there you can hear him saying, lock him up. So a couple things on this. First of all, I thought that a crowd chanting lock him up or send her back or whatever else chant, that that was dangerous, that that was inciting violence, and it really shows just how evil and dangerous Trump supporters are. Now, I don't like it when they chant things like send her back or lock her up. I have openly been critical of that in the past. You can go back, look through my show archives on the day after it happens, every single time without fail. As long as I was aware of it happening, if I talk about it at all, I condemn it. Now, I might think that Hillary Clinton actually does need to be in jail, but I don't think that chanting lock her up as a crowd is a productive use of time. I don't think that it's the right thing to do. I think it sends the wrong message. And so I don't like it when crowds do that. But what is hilarious here is that that was the head story on CNN, all the primetime shows. They did a segment on it. It was almost always their top story. MSNBC, ABC News, all the major alphabet soup networks. They all got together and talked about how, oh, this just shows how dangerous Trump supporters are, how they're evil and racist and how they can't be trusted. This is spurring on of violence. This is going to be encouraging people to attack or assassinate the people that this is being directed towards. I never bought that narrative. Not once. And what's hilarious is you don't see Don Lemon and Chris Cuomo and Wolf Blitzer or Rachel Maddow or any of the other people up there, the talking heads on these networks. You don't see them saying, oh, this just shows how incredibly dangerous people in D.C. are, how incredibly dangerous people that oppose President Trump are. I mean, goodness, why was he even still there? He could have been assassinated. This was they were spurring on violence. Yeah, well, Trump sat there for almost the entire game. I think he left in the eighth inning. And he was fine. These people don't like him, but they didn't try to hurt him or kill him. And that's also true of the vast overwhelming majority of the Trump supporters. Maybe you could find some nut job in a Trump rally that would be willing to hurt somebody. But the vast overwhelming majority of Americans, just because they don't like a political figure, are not going to try to hurt him. And it's wrong for them to characterize Trump supporters and cast them in that light, especially when they refuse to do it, when literally the exact same thing is happening on the other side. All of a sudden, when the chants and taunts are directed at Trump, oh, well, there's nothing to see here. It's not dangerous. This is why people do not trust the media, because they have shown themselves time and time again to be dangerous hypocrites. And the irony in all of this, and there were even people on the left that were kind of laughing at it and reveling in it, this shows why Trump was in office. Ultimately, this is why Trump was in office, not because of baseball specifically. The reason that those chants were so loud and it was the overwhelming majority of the people there is because DC is an uber left city. In fact, it may very well be, if you control for population, the most Democrat, the bluest city in the country. As of the last time they checked it, the breakdown of registered Democrats versus registered Republicans in the city of Washington, D.C. is about 75-5. Washington, D.C. went 95% for Hillary Clinton in the last election. People in D.C. despise Trump, and that's the reason that people wanted him there. They wanted him there because they were sick of a bunch of arrogant, pompous jerks in D.C. that think they know better than the rest of the country trying to run their life. That's what the Trump election was ultimately about. Didn't vote for the guy myself. Didn't necessarily believe that he was going to be the guy that drained the swamp. But the point is, a majority of the American people did. Or at least enough to get him in through the Electoral College. At least enough in some of those Rust Belt states for him to win those states that he needed. Ultimately, that is the reason that Donald Trump is in office right now, because the people in D.C. don't like him. And that's a good thing. That is an admirable thing. That's one of the things that, even though some days I feel better about Trump than others, that is one thing that I've always said that is a positive about President Trump, is that the establishment types can't stand him. And the fact that the city of D.C. overwhelmingly dislikes President Trump, that is just extra reason to like him, according to most Americans in the heartland and right here in Alabama. And they should. It's also the same reason that you recently saw a push by Democrats to try to make D.C. into a state in and of itself. They would love nothing more than to have two senators, two extra senators, for the Democrats on there. Because if you're looking at numbers like that, there is no chance that a Republican winds up taking that slot. Now, it would make a lot more sense from a legal perspective to either incorporate DC into Maryland or Virginia if you were going to try to say, well, they need representation as a state. The whole reason the founders did not want that to take place is because they wanted DC to be as impartial towards the state interest as humanly possible. And that's the reason statehood is a bad idea. But if you believe that they made that decision in error, and you wanted it to have representation in a state as part of that, they already have representation, they already have an electoral vote, they already have all these other things. But if you believe that, the smarter and simpler way to do so would be to incorporate them into one of the two bordering states. The reason they don't want to do that is because Democrats want extra senators and extra representatives. And they know that they are guaranteed to be all blue, and that's the reason they're pushing for it. They're pushing this not because they believe that DC is somehow being disenfranchised. They're doing this because they know it will create the maximum amount of impact for the Democrats on the federal stage. Because are you really going to tell me that people like AOC would be in favor of DC statehood if they knew that it was going to be two new Republican senators and a couple of Republican representatives in the House? No. Nobody believes that. And if you do, you're a moron. All right, let's go ahead and jump to the chaplain's report.
In 1775, the Continental Congress created the Chaplain Corps. Under the command of General George Washington, each soldier was required to attend worship service every Sunday. While other armies advanced on their feet, Washington's troops advanced on their knees. It's time for the Chaplain's Report with Caleb Colquitt on tactics.
Chaplain's Report today does come from the Psalms, and I love the Psalms. Of course, it's important to remember that each of the Psalms are actually written poetically and done in such a way that they can be sung. So it's important to remember that this is a song that was intended to be sung as a praise toward God, because I think putting it in that context actually helps us understand some of the significance of the words chosen in this. So we're going to look at the 99th Psalm, and we're going to read the whole thing. The Lord reigns. Let the peoples tremble. He is enthroned above the cherubim. Let the earth shake. The Lord is great in Zion, and he is exalted above all the peoples. Let them praise your great and awesome name. Holy is he. The strength of the king loves justice. You have established equity. You have executed justice and righteousness in Jacob. Exalt the Lord our God, and worship at his footstool. Holy is he. Moses and Aaron were among his priests, and Samuel was among those who called on his name. They called upon the Lord, and he answered them. He spoke to them in the pillar of the cloud. They kept his testimonies and the statute that he gave to them. O Lord our God, you answered them. You were a forgiving God to them, and yet an avenger of their evil deeds. Exalt the Lord our God, and worship at his holy hill, for holy is the Lord our God. One of the reasons that I preface that by saying, remember, this is a song of praise to God, is that it's a little bit foreign to us, not because it's a theologically incorrect idea, but because we're just not accustomed to hearing it as often, to think of God being an avenger as a good thing. You see, when you're looking at Jewish culture and the way that the Jews who would have understood these Psalms in their day looked at it, you see them often crying out for justice. You see them often crying out for God to come and set things right. You don't see that as much from Christians. And I think it's because Jesus really changed that emphasis and put the emphasis on setting them right in me. In other words, your struggle is not so much against society, and it's not so much against the world as it is internally. And I think that there's some reasons for that. First of all, the New Testament is the law of the heart. The Old Testament is a law for a nation. And obviously a nation has far more to do with the dealings of the world. They have far more to do with the ins and outs and the goings on of this planet. If it's an internal struggle, you're certainly aware of that stuff, but you're really only paying attention to it as it pertains to your spiritual well-being. That was a transition that Jesus Christ coming down to earth made, and I think it's an appropriate one. But I think it's important to understand that the Jews were praising God for his vengeance and wrath, which is something that seems a little odd to a modern Christian, but it's something that is wholly appropriate. They loved God's justice and should have. And actually, in that very psalm, you see a reason for that. It was not that they were blind. It's not that they believed, oh, well, I really want God to come down and bring some justice here because he's going to bring it to those people over there. No, that's not what the psalmist said at all. In fact, if you look back and we'll look at the last verses here, look at what he said about some of the people that served God. Moses and Aaron were among his priests, and Samuel was among those who called on his name. And then you skip down there, and it says, yet the Lord gave was an avenger of their evil deeds, there in verse 8. So these were not people that were blinded or believed that God was just going to bring justice to those bad people over there, and he's going to protect me. The psalmist is saying, no, God brings justice to everybody that does wrong. God is not a respecter of person. Even if we're looking at people like the prophet Samuel, or Moses, or Aaron, when they did something wrong, God punished them for it. And they were better people because of that. You see, God's punishment is viewed as a blessing in and of itself, and should be. God's correction should be something that we want to happen to us. Sure, we don't like it in the process, just like if you're looking back at your own childhood, you didn't like getting a whooping, or you didn't like having your favorite toy taken away, or you didn't like being grounded. But ultimately, you're glad that it happened because it made you into the person that you are today, and it instilled discipline and morality into you. Believe me, I've talked to people that don't have a great home life, and that didn't when they were children, and didn't really get punished as kids because their parents didn't care enough about them to do that. And they wish that they had that in their life. God's punishment is something that we should strive for. It's something that we should desire God to give to us because it is a show of his affection. that he is concerned enough about us, about our physical, mental, and spiritual well-being, as well as the decisions that we make, that he wants to correct those errors so that we can be better suited to serve him. He did it with people like Moses and Aaron. He did it with people like Abraham. He did it with people all throughout the New and Old Testament. And it's something that we should view as something we desire for him to do to us. It's a correction that we should welcome so that we can be better suited to serve him as his children. Stay the course, friends.
Tactics is a production of News Radio 1440 and Cumulus Media Montgomery. Any opinions expressed on this program are those of the host and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Cumulus Media. The theme song for Tactics is 6 Foot Town by Big and Rich. Graphics by Jessica Dawson. Broadcast studios provided by Cumulus Media Montgomery. Location studios provided by the Dalreda Church of Christ. Copyright 2019.